So you put up with about 31 minutes of a rerun of last night's program, and I thank you for that. This is now live. It is the 31st day of May, 2013. I have just a few minutes ago roared through the door after I don't know, feeling like a bit player in that scene from Beetlejuice that takes place in the DMV, the eternal equivalent of the DMV. You remember, where Michael Keaton tries to steal the number from the guy sitting next to him and winds up getting his head shrunk. Yeah, that. Welcome to Friday on the Front Porch. This is The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid. Is this thing on? Have I got all the right switches? Yeah, it looks like it. It looks like it. So, no, we'll get at least 2.5 hours worth of a show in, or some portion thereof. It's a lovely day here today. I wish I could say that I was just late getting home from playing hooky, but no, I realized at the last minute, practically, that my license plates were going to expire tomorrow. And, of course, you know that I plan to be on the road Sunday for Washington, D.C., and there's something about, well, it's bad enough driving around in West Virginia with bad plates. It would suck especially, however, to be doing it in the Old Dominion, Virginia, because I think they still have capital punishment for license plate infractions over there. So that was the delay at the DMV, which closes at 5, which I got to at 8 minutes till 5, and which then took another, I think 35 to 45 minutes to get done with before you get the idea. Just another day. And see, I don't know. Who takes care of DMV issues for the guys to get paid millions of, and women who get paid millions of dollars to do this? I don't know. Is that part of the staff? You know, Mr. Snerdley, go take care of my new registration, please. I'll just be sitting here chewing these little things up to get the refreshing burst of flavor. Do they even drive? Do they live anything resembling an ordinary, notice I did not use the word normal, life? I don't think so. No, when you've got enough money that you can send out a Cuban cigar box full of money and get a Cuban cigar box full of street narcotics, you're not living an ordinary life. And you're not living an ordinary life when you live in a 27,000 square foot mansion with your maid, a cat, and your wife in a pit in the basement. You're just not. But that's neither here nor there, and it's certainly not complaining or bellyaching on my part. It was my fault for letting the due date sneak up on me. Oh, what did Wordsworth say? The world is too much with us. We lay waste our something giving it going and coming and getting and spending. We lay waste our, I'm not even going to look it up, because I'd rather get going on Friday on the Front Porch. And you know what that's about. That's the weird little stories that we've taken a pass on over the course of over the course of the week. And you know what? We've got plenty of them. A lot of them. We've talked a lot, and we've been in the habit of talking a lot about edumacation. And I've got a story here out of the Washington Post. It's from the answer sheet blog by Valerie Strauss. Here, let me go ahead and get this out of the way. Yes, it is the last day of May. No, we have not met the fundraising goal, and no, we are not out of the $300 hole that we dug for ourselves last month, but we're nearly there. We're nearly there. About $350 is where we stand as far as getting there. So if we can do that between now and midnight, $35 at 10 people, 10 people at 35, 35 people at 10, you know, however you want to work it. And thanks for getting us, all of you, thanks for getting us as close as we have gotten. I know, I realize these holes are difficult to get out of, but the PayPal button is at headonradionetwork.com, and you can also, under the tab Contribute, find the traditional overland carbon-intensive mail address. So, no, we talked about education some, and this blog post out of the Washington Post concerns a teacher by the name of Ron Maggiano. The headline says, "Award-winning Virginia teacher, I can no longer cooperate with testing regime." And I was reminded that maybe this might be a fun story to get going on Friday on the front porch with, simply because, well, one of the reasons it was such an absolute joy to get from here, the 40 miles to the DMV and back, was because it's graduation evening for three separate high schools. The one pathetic attempt at a high school that's a few miles up the road, another one that's across the river, and the great big one in Beckley. Oh, brother. I took back roads for a reason. But anyway, Ron Maggiano teaches at West Springfield High School in Fairfax County, Virginia. And he has been much honored. He was the Disney teacher, winning the Disney Teacher Award for Innovation and Creativity in 2005, the American Historical Association's Beverage Family Teaching Prize was awarded to him in 2006 for outstanding K-12 teaching, and now he's punting. After a 33-year career in education, he says, "I don't think I'm leaving the education system. I think the education system left me." And when I read that, anybody, that just click for you? Is that a trigger? Have you ever heard the phrase like that before? Because I have. I don't think I'm leaving the education system. I think the education system left me. Ms. Strauss, who writes this blog, says that she received an email from Mr. Maggiano in which he said, "I have taught history at West Springfield High School for the past 19 years. I've been a successful classroom teacher for more than 30 years, but now I have had enough. As a result of the obsessive emphasis on standardized test scores in FCPS, that would be Fairfax County Public Schools, and across the educational landscape, I've decided to retire at the end of the current academic year. I've made this decision because I can no longer cooperate with a testing regime that I believe is suffocating creativity and innovation in the classroom. We are not really educating our students anymore. We are merely teaching them to pass a test. This is wrong, period." He goes on to note that I'm 4 years away from full retirement, so my decision to retire was not made lightly. It will cost me. Our school newspaper, The Oracle, just ran a story on my retirement and why I'm leaving the classroom on the job that, and the job that I love. And then the blog post also reprints the story from the high school newspaper. Now, I go back to that line. I don't think I'm leaving the education system. I think the education system left me. Ponder that for a moment. Getting some audio complaints in the chat room, so I'm trying to tweak a little bit, but I think I'm all tweaked out. Never thought of myself as a tweaker. But anyway, I don't think I'm leaving the education system. I think the education system left me. Maybe if you were not living in the Deep South during the so-called Reagan Revolution, you won't recognize that phrase. But if you have lived in the Deep South during the Reagan Revolution, you can spot that phrase from a mile away, because that was the phrase that was used by the so-called Reagan Democrats, who many of whom went on to become Reagan Republicans. They said, "I didn't leave the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party left me." Which was an excuse maker's way of saying, Democratic Party's paying way too much attention to them people. And we all know who them people are. Right? And that line prompted me to go all the way through the rest of the blog post. Let's see, the newspaper story, the high school newspaper story about him, says Maggiano has been teaching here for 19 years. Now that he's leaving, he's looking into working at a historical society or in a museum as an education coordinator. Students have been sad to hear he is retiring from our school system. Okay. And I freely admit that I may be way off base on this, but I think we at least get to ask a few questions about a story like this. Why is it, and the professional educators can chime in on this, but why is it that in 2013, when this individual has been teaching quite successfully, apparently, all through a teaching regime that focuses on teaching to the test since the passage of No Child's Behind left, which was early in George W. Bush's first term, why is he suddenly now disgusted? Well, I think I have an answer. I don't like the answer I think I have, but I think I have an answer. And the answer itself is in this story, in this blog post. This is what happens when I get a late start. No, the answer is in the post itself. After you've read Mr. Maggiano's email, after you've read the story about him from the high school where he teaches, all the way down the third full paragraph, or the third paragraph from the bottom, reads as follows, and it's by way of just talking about how active Mr. Maggiano has been. And it reads as such, as follows. Maggiano started teaching right out of college in the music department. Okay, nothing to fault there. However, after several years of teaching band and chorus, which is fine, we applaud the arts on this little radio network, he decided to switch to teaching history. Well, okay. Since then, he's taught for 33 years. I'm trying to do the math on this. He's taught for 33 years, several years of, and then 19 years he's been at that one particular school, I think he said. And he decided to switch to teaching history. Yay, history teachers! We love you! Since then, he's taught courses on U.S., European, and world history, and he's enjoyed working with other great teachers in all those subjects. Okay, this is still good. He's also actively participated in WS's, that's West Springfield's, after-school clubs. Working with, you ready for the drum roll now? because this is a public high school in Fairfax County, old Virginia. And Fairfax County ain't exactly poor. So he, being a dedicated educator, has given of his time to various after-school groups. The first one mentioned, and yes, there's a little bit of irony involved in this. One thinks of, oh, I don't know, Spartacus or Kirk Douglas playing Spartacus. He's worked with, he actively participated in West Springfield's after-school clubs. Apparently West Springfield, Virginia, are the Spartans. Never understood why anybody would name their team the Spartans if they knew so much as one flippin' iota about who the Spartans were. You know, the Spartans did, they had their own little subclass of people whom they treated as subhuman. They were called Helots, H-E-L-O-T-S. And one of the critical parts of the Spartan coming-of-age manhood ritual was for a young Spartan warrior to go out and either beat nearly to death or actually kill one of the Helots. Nice bunch, the Spartans. So I chuckled a little bit when I read the name of the group. He has also actively participated in West Springfield's after-school clubs, working with Spartans for Christ. Okay. The Chess Club, well, all right. And the Young Republicans Club. Oh, we have our answer, don't we? After all these years, he says there's one thing that's kept him coming back. The kids. This school has great kids, said Maggiano. Spartans for Christ, the Chess Club, and the Young Republicans Club. So let's review. Mr. Maggiano has taught for 33 years, and he was winning awards back in 2005 and 2006 during the George W. Bush No Child's Behind Left regime, the absolute ferocious, intense determination to teach to the test having been made inside No Child's Behind Left that was actively touted by George W. Bush and his cadre of flim-flam artists in the U.S. Department of Education and outside the U.S. Department of Education, which included, of course, his licentious and perhaps somewhat larcenous brother, Neil, who went out and ginned himself up go figure, who could imagine it? An educational testing company. Or some sort of an outfit that was associated with teaching to the test and whatnot. And Mr. Maggiano was doing just fine. He was doing so well, he got a couple of fairly prestigious awards. That was 2005 and 2006, and he soldiered on bravely through 2007, and 2008 saw the departure of Dim Leader. And then in 2009, well, he began to have doubts. And he hung on through 2012, hoping America might be taken back. But then came November 2012, and the mechanical construct known as Bishop Willard Romney was rejected wholesale by the voters of the United States, despite the best efforts of the Republican Party to keep a lot of people from voting at all. Yep, Neil Bush, test prep materials. Thank you, Texas Betsy. No, in November 2012, it began to become clear. It began to become clear to him that he's not leaving the education system. The education system had left him. It's kind of like standing by a railroad track at a railroad depot and waiting until after the train has been gone for, let's say the train's been gone for 7 hours, 1 hour per year since, since 2006. And suddenly realizing when another train pulls up with a conductor you don't like the looks of, and letting that train go, and then saying, I didn't refuse to get on the train. The train left me. It was a bothersome story. Because I'm sympathetic. And I noticed a post from Faith on Facebook the other day. And she was talking about her own objections to the core curriculum and the core standards and whatnot. But bemoaning the idea that we have to get in line with a bunch of right-wingers and Agenda 21 people and people who hate fluoridation. People, you know, the little right-wingers concerned about their precious bodily fluids. And Faith's conclusion, as I understand it, was no, I won't. I'll maintain my own concerns and make my own objections, but I'm not going to go over and mingle with that bunch. Which, of course, runs contrary to the entire pestiferous theme that is maintained by the for-profit media these days that what we need is some bipartisanship in Washington, D.C. We need a bipartisan determination that Granny needs to starve. We need a bipartisan determination that those little four-year-olds damn well don't need that head start. What we need is some bipartisan austerity. I'm a parent of teenagers. Well, I'm a parent of a 20-something, too. I also happen to be a grandparent of little ones, the first one having, on Wednesday, just graduated kindergarten. I've seen my children throw up because of the stress put on them because of standardized testing. I've watched what used to be a decent little high school, the one my children go to, become a nasty little hellhole in the space of 6 or 7 or 8 years. So you're not going to catch me defending corporatized, standardized testing. But unless I'm told something else, I'm more than a little suspicious about this story. How is it that you can, just simply put, how is it that you can live through 8 years of testing hell and figure out that you can just get up and go on another day, but then you go through 4 more years, and suddenly after the re-election of that one, I didn't leave the education system left me. Does that make me intolerant? I hope not. I hope what it makes me is skeptical. Because I think a healthy dose of skepticism is probably beneficial to us all. I have no doubt that there are a lot of teachers who have bailed out on working and teaching because of the way the education system has been reshaped. On the other hand, a lot of those who have gotten out without saying things like, I didn't leave the education system left me. And do let's remember that No Child's Behind Left was designed to create, not discover, but to create failing public school systems. Okay, Betsy pointing out that it is worse than 2008 because the tests got harder and now all kids must pass, including special ed and new English language learners. They've made it impossible so that they can close the schools after selling us consultants. But that was part of the design all along. It's going to take a little bit more convincing, Betsy, for me to believe this guy who was actively involved in Spartans for Christ, which, of course, has no business on a public school campus. And the Young Republicans Club. You know, you don't get in there and sponsor the Young Republicans Club unless you're fairly political in the first place. 19 years at that high school. 1903. Yeah, since 1994. So he weathered the six long, hellish remaining years of the Clinton administration and the great Clinton penis hunt. And then the eight sunlight years of the dim leader return to traditional American values, uniquely American values. 4 years of that one, but at the beginning of the second term, I didn't leave the education system. The education system left me. So we have that. Meanwhile, out there somewhere, we have the story out of a school in Texas, identified, I think, by a researcher at Southern Methodist University. A school where they teach a Bible class in Texas, in which children are asked questions by a 64-year-old alleged teacher who is also a preacher. They're asked questions like, how will our bodies be different after the resurrection? Oops. Yeah. Oh, and speaking of education, a little promo or a program note. At 3 p.m. tomorrow, the newest class in the Prism West Virginia series opens. And it's a class on leadership. And it will be based, as all the other Prism classes have been, on primary sources and on real history. 3 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time tomorrow, noon Pacific Daylight Time. And it will be available on the Horn Stream and in the Horn Dropbox, and on Ustream as well. We hope to get the Ustream player back working. John Fox said he would try to take a look at it today. Get it back working so that you can just go to Prism, PRISMWV.org, and watch these things. Otherwise, you go to Ustream.tv and simply search Prism American History Chats. So there's that. And then a couple of updates. We're leaving the education forum. A couple of updates. One of which has to do with our with the story we talked about regarding the sale of Smithfield Meats to the Chinese. Well, it turns out it's worse than we thought. I think I mentioned in talking about the story itself that the outfit purchasing Smithfield, the Chinese outfit, is backed by none other than Goldman Sachs. You, just as my youngest daughter would say, and she's very good at it.
Yep.
Well, the folks over at Think Progress, who do a lot of good work, did a little more digging into the Smithfield world, and it's not a pretty picture. Headline over at Think Progress, under Health: Chinese meat firm with terrible food safety record buys the largest pork producer in the U.S. They note, with one giant conglomeration controlling most of the meat market, food safety standards may drop to even more abysmal depths. Neither Smithfield nor Shanghui have shown much interest in reforming their production practices, even after sickening thousands. And here's the Shanghui part of it. These are the folks who were buying Smithfield. In 2011, a Shanghui plant was caught feeding their pigs an illegal additive, clenbuterol, to speed muscle growth. Five people were charged with harsh criminal sentences, and dozens of others were punished. Well, hey, well, let's hear it for the Chinese that they even did that. We'd give a medal to them over here. A month after the discovery, however, nearly 300 people fell violently ill from eating clenbuterol-tainted pork. So there's a graphic and a graph available with it. Pork consumption in China has risen to 52 million tons in somewhere around now. 52 million tons. You don't just add a third shift to come up with 52 million tons at one of these CAFO hog nightmares. We're going to be externalizing, as noted, we're going to be externalizing poisons and sickness and misery on the more communities, defenseless communities, who have no means, well, they're defenseless, of pushing back. In 2010, a Humane Society video exposed horrific conditions inside a Smithfield factory. Promises were made. Promises have not thus far been kept. That might be a new word you want to jot down. Clenbuterol, C-L-E-N-B-U-T-E-R-O-L. I like my pork with a little hickory smoke. Not clenbuterol. So there's that. And from a pig of one sort to a pig of another, an update on our recent hero, David Kokhead, or Koresh, Kokesh. You remember that he was the one who was planning the armed march on Washington, D.C., where we're going to come in peace unless they make it unpeaceful for us. Right? Well, in a way, I guess you have to give Kokesh, that is his name, right? It's not Koresh. You have to give Kokesh brownie points for creativity. I think he began to realize that he and his gun goober buddies were going to have a problem if they tried that armed march on Washington, D.C. thing. Even though he's well on track to having the 10,000 people he demanded in order for the thing to go forward, he's up past 5,200. But he's bailed on the march. Oh, this guy's got real flim-flam talent, without a doubt. He has declared that he is in the business of forming a new, and these are his words, American Revolutionary Army. And they are talking secession. You heard me. Secession. Over at a website that, I don't know, I think psychosis is involved. A quick little sidelight, because I was out running around desperately trying to get back here to the mansion in time for a show. I got to listen to a little bit of radio, and, you know, we were asking questions yesterday about when will the for-profit media start referring to things like sending poisonous letters to the President of the United States or the Mayor of New York as an assassination attempt. Still not there. I mean, come on. NPR? Really? NPR can't refer to it as an assassination attempt? Even if it is? No. The closest they got today was to refer to the ricin-laced letters as violence. Haven't even quite made it all the way to terrorism, because after all, since the guy referenced his guns, well, that means he's probably white. And therefore, to refer to right-wing domestic terrorism is probably a bridge too far, even for National Petroleum Radio. But anyway, back to Adam Koresh, Kokesh. The thing was dated May the 24th, this little screed. They say, what follows is Kokesh's complete and unabridged statement. Oh, Jesus. Well, let's hear the whole thing just for the fun of it. When a government has repeatedly and deliberately failed to follow its own laws... Okay, this is where we would want that first little number one up above the S in laws to direct us for a footnote to know what you're... violated the fundamental human rights of its citizens, that'd be number little two, threatened the sanctity of a free press, three, created institutions intended to eliminate privacy of communication, that would be the four, waged war at the behest of special interests that threatens the public safety, five, killed hundreds. He's trying to work a sort of a Declaration of Independence gig here, but he ain't no Jefferson. It gets down to the, let's see, stolen from the people through an absurd system of taxation and inflation. Buy gold now. There's never been a better time to buy gold. Gold is your best hedge against inflation. Buy gold now. You can buy yourself a vacuum cleaner with the gold that'll pick up a bowling ball off a Swedish mattress and have enough money left over to buy some hair tonic to herbally grow hair on your bald head. And God only knows, maybe if you get an erection lasting more than 4 hours, well, thank Jeebus. And so after his little preamble, Mr. Kokesh says, "A new American revolution is long overdue. This revolution has been brewing in the hearts and minds of the people for many years." The only problem is he's using the word revolution, and I think the word he's thinking about is treason. Because it is fairly clearly defined in the Constitution. What was it? Article 3? Section 2? Taking up arms against the United States? "This revolution has been brewing in the hearts and minds of the people for many years, but this Independence Day it shall take a new form as the American Revolutionary Army." This stupid bastard is raising an army. "We'll march on each state capital." Now, see, this is where we understand that he's got a little bit of the P.T. Barnum huckster in him, too. See, at one point he wanted 10,000 people to march on Washington, D.C., as, of course, he led from the rear. But now he wants 50 individual marches on the state capitals with guns, thinking that maybe he can insulate himself from a bit of liability. "The American Revolutionary Army will march on each state capital, demand that the governors of these 50 states immediately initiate the process of an orderly dissolution of the federal government through secession and reclamation of federally held property." This little bastard's going to try to get somebody to take a pot shot at Fort Sumter, or maybe Fort Hood, or Fort Benning, or Fort McClellan. Or, wait a minute, Fort Knox. Is there still some gold there? "Should one whole year from this July 4th pass while the crimes of this government," that's another place that really need a footnote, "are allowed to continue, we may have passed the point at which nonviolent revolution becomes impossible." You hear that? "Should one whole year from this July 4th pass while the crimes of this government are allowed to continue, we may have passed the point at which nonviolent revolution becomes impossible." Funny, that's where he used the may phrase instead of the shall phrase. And for any of you who don't want to get your freedom-protecting penile extension shooting gun out and go march on a state capitol this July 4th instead of going and enjoying some barbecue or whatnot, and he has a message for you, too. "The time to sit idly by has passed. To remain neutral is to be complicit. Just doing your job is not an excuse, and the line in the sand has been drawn between the people and the criminals in Washington, D.C. While some timid souls will say that it is too early, that we can solve this problem through democratic means provided by government, that current levels of taxation are reasonable for the services provided, and that the crimes of this government are merely a tolerable nuisance, it may already be too late. While there is a risk in drastic action, the greater danger lies in allowing this government to continue unchallenged. So if you are content with the status quo, stay home, get fat, watch the fireworks from a safe distance, and allow this Independence Day to pass like any other. But if you see as we see and feel as we feel, we will see you on the front lines of freedom on July 4th, 2013 for this, the final American Revolution. Oh, by the way, up in that preamble paragraph where he complains about stuff, he complains about drone strikes. Has anybody found out whether Code Pink has any plans to bring him some chocolates and flowers and talk about how large his testicles are? Just asking, because I mean, that's what got the progressives all up in a stir about liberal hero Rand Paul, libertarian ophthalmologist. So you know, you may not have to. Apparently, there's not going to be an armed march on Washington D.C. this July 4th, which may mean that we actually get to go to July 4th of July in Washington D.C. this time. On the other hand, if you live in any of the 50 state capitals, Mr. Kokesh is saying you're going to get some fireworks of an entirely different kind. Now, I want to make sure that I'm not getting anything wrong here. Hang on. Yeah, there it is. Article 3. Section 3. Treason against the United States shall consist only in levying war against them or in adhering to their enemies, giving them aid and comfort. Okay. Is he trying to be too clever by half in changing from Washington, D.C. to, for instance, the 50 state capitals? Oh, no. We weren't. No. We were just demanding that they secede. That's all. Or was this a logistics thing, where you figure it's easier to get a bunch of goobs to march on Sacramento than to come all the way to Washington, D.C.? I mean, really. And if you march on a state capital or proceed to try to seize federal property, have you levied war against the United States? Notice that in the text of the Constitution, treason against the United States shall consist only in levying war against them, not it. Pronouns matter. So let's say you do get up out of your bed and crawl out of your hovel there in Bug Tussle with your shooting gun, and head on up to Little Rock to march on the state capitol and demand secession? Have you levied war against them? If you urge secession of Arkansas, have you levied war against the other 49? I get no pride. I get no joy. I get no pleasure whatsoever out of seeing something like this after having for many years now remarked upon the ugly, ugly, ugly secessionist trend in the right wing of these United States. None. Oh, by the way, I said 10 at 35 for this evening. That would be $350 we need to close out the evening's the month's fundraising. Well, Betsy got us started. $35 rolling in, and all she sends is a note saying, only 9 more needed. That's not that difficult, is it? No. So 8 at 35, or any combination thereof, to finish fundraising for the month of May and the month of April, and get us started on an even foot in June. So there's that. It's about 24 minutes past the hour, and lines are open. Skype line's open, Bob Kincaid Horn, and so too are the phone lines, 304-658-3333. Hey, welcome to the program.
How's it going, Bob?
Ah, pretty good. Is this Dave?
You know, this is Dave. You got my voice down by now, huh? Anyway, so what's going on? Are you talking about Mr. what's his name with the guns?
Yeah.
I guess he's chickened out and going to Washington now, so that's I'm so disappointed, you know. Just looking forward to that. Oh, well.
Well, no, it looks like he's going to come to Salem.
Oh, I think I'm doing the math over here. I think he's going to have about 50 times as many cops in 50 states as he was looking at in Washington, D.C. But I think I read something about how the police chief over there in Washington, D.C. said, well, we have laws over here, and they break the laws, we'll have to put them in jail. And so he chickened out on that. And so, yeah, remember I was telling you about going down to the down to Salem and testifying in front of the Judiciary Committee, all that stuff. At the
right,
Judiciary
right.
Committee? Yeah, that Sid and Lie bill died in committee. It didn't make it, so it went down. I was very gratified to find that out. But, did you ever work on cars? Have you done any work on cars?
I can change my oil. I can change an air filter.
That basic stuff. Yeah, I was funny.
I busted my knuckles trying to do some other things.
Oh yeah, but you've never done an overhaul or any of that kind of stuff.
No, but I know people who have. I watched it done.
Yeah. Because I used to be a mechanic. I used to restore classic cars. And,
cool.
I was born and raised down in Los Angeles, so I was fascinated with the old cars when I was a kid. But I was just out here in my neighborhood here in Southeast Portland. It's a beautiful day over here today, by the way. But anyway, I was riding my bike around, and these two younger guys are working on this really nice Chevy truck, and they were having a hell of a time. I stopped and started talking with them, and I think I found the problem, what it was, and I was going to see if you could confirm that for me, but I had talked to another friend. It's just a long roundabout story. I think they got a broken camshaft in their small block Chevy engine now, so they're kind of SOL on that, I think. But it's a beautiful truck. It's totally worth putting a new engine into or overhauling that.
About what year?
It's a 73, but it's like one of these Sierra camper specials.
Yeah.
It belonged to some old fella that put a new paint job on it, and it's just got like a rhino lining bed in the back, and it's got the diamond plate toppers on the bed.
Wait, so they did all that before they found out if the engine was any good?
Well, maybe the engine. I'm thinking that the engine may it's got a problem with it's either the distributor or the camshaft. I narrowed it down to that pretty fast with these fellows. They had done everything else to it. They put a new carburetor on it. They changed the starter. They changed everything on it. But I'm believing more and more that it's the camshaft on it, which is not an easy job on those cars. It's not like an overhead cam where it's right up there where you can get to it. You got to do like major internal surgery on it. It's a heavy job, but in any case, it's no big deal. I'm just I made some friends there on the spot, and
nice.
I was just admiring this truck, though. It's just a really nice truck. Other than that, it was just in perfect shape. And they had bought it from an older fellow that had done it up and then had a stroke the next week and sat in the garage for six months, in the widow's garage for 6 months, and then she finally decided to sell it, I guess, when she went to the old folks' home. And so it's kind of a gem of a find, you know.
Yeah, those. It seems like everybody and their cousin gets those. I've never found one, but you know, it's the Porsche 958 or whatever, or the 1954 Porsche that sat in some guy's garage for 60 years and has,
yeah, yeah,
you know, it's been out enough to keep it running, but it's got 3,000 original miles on it. No, those kind of stories just made me beat my head against the wall.
Well, over there, it's different because when I say over there, I mean like over in the East Coast or Midwest or something, because you guys they put salt on the roads and you know, they have acid rain and
right.
Body get pretty chewed up. I mean, I have this other buddy around the corner from me. He just bought this truck at the auction at the Ford and it's just chewed up. I said, dude, this thing must have been at the beach or out on, you know, it came from the Midwest or something, because it's just the cars over here on the West Coast generally. I mean, we're going to get more acid rain now thanks to China, but over, you know, in the past, the cars over here are really fairly solid and decent, and you know, it's different. The cars are in generally better shape over here. Interiors are, and the old cars will burn out from the sun, but that aside, and you know, the body itself on an old car, they're generally better.
No, but I am a shameless car freak, like I was talking with Albert about last night. I have a hopeless passion for them.
I started out like restoring classic cars, and then you know I was into power and big engines, and then I got the 61 Chevy. I had a 61 Bel Air that was so clean, but it was like a really super plain Jane machine. It just had an inline six and it had power nothing. It had a three on the tree and it was the most basic mechanical device that you could ever think of. And, I mean, for 1961, it had no power features on it, and it was the greatest car. I loved that car. Got 20 to the gallon, and it was just, you know, I kind of surged in it in a direction of efficiency after that, to the point where until 2010, I had a Prius, which I really loved too. It got repoed, and Toyota's coming after me now for the because I was underwater about $4,000, $5,000.
Yeah, you know, merciless.
They're suing me, but I'm gonna just, I don't know. I don't know. They're not throwing people in jail for debt out here yet. So, you know.
Well, thank heaven for small favors on that point.
Yeah, we don't have the debtor's prisons out here yet. It's not as bad as Texas or anything, but I'll settle it up.
Well, I was going to say, by all means, see if you can, you know, because they'll take pennies on the dollar just to get it off the books.
Yeah, I just have to have, you know, a decent chunk of change to settle up with them somehow on it. But I just got to get something going on here. I've got to get some work or got to get, I don't know.
I don't know. It sounds to me like you've got a future back under the hood or something.
Well, I don't know. I sold cars for a long time, and I know I've heard that car sales are really good now, but I just hated doing that. I really did. It's spiritually taxing. It really is. And I got really good at it too, so it got really boring, because I've heard every one-liner on a car lot 1,000 times in my life. And it's just,
oh, you're the guy the car salesmen hate to keep. Car salesmen hate to see coming.
I was like, actually, you know, I used to be very kind to car salesmen, but I just would tell them, I said, let's just do a fast deal, and I wouldn't let them get to me. I wouldn't let them upset me. I'd generally, you know, just joke around with them and just tell them, you know, we'd be on the test drive, and I'd turn to the salesman and go, you know, I don't really like you very much, but. We might still be able to do a deal or something like that. I don't know. I just would always tend to to try to make them laugh and tell them what I was wanted to pay, and you know, you want to do it, we'll do it, and otherwise, and I would always, you know, make them a reasonable offer. Not the kind of a person that would stress out over $100 too much or something like that, just because it just ain't worth it, you know. I've seen so too many people just agonize over pennies, and I don't know. It's just not worth it. But yeah, it's been a really nice week. I just had a really, really good.
Well, this is when it's supposed to start getting just. It's absolutely beautiful out there where you are.
Oh yeah, it was really nice yesterday too. It was kind of cloudy and it drizzled a little bit, but the sun would come out intermittently. And today is just like a couple of minor little clouds in the sky, and it's like.
Well, from here on till what, November, it'll just be paradise.
Well, off and on, you know, we're getting some weird weather. Like last June, we had record rainfall in June for Portland. And the weirdest thing about it was, that, you know, this is a phenomenon due to global warming that's happening all over the world, actually, where half of the rain that we had in June happened in like 15 minutes. Seriously, we had like a downpour that was just a torrential, like Midwest, you know, supercell type downpour over here in like on June 6th or something like that. But the way it rains here usually is it drizzles, you know. It just doesn't, you know, we'll have steady rain, but an inch a day is a lot. It's not like where I come from, like Los Angeles, where, you know, they would have 3-inch days there where it would rain 3 inches and the streets flood and
yeah,
no stopping it. But
yeah, it's, when I was visiting Vegas a couple of summers ago, I was told horror stories about, you know, rainstorms in Vegas. You know, when they do come, they're just ugly.
Yeah, yeah, it's like a flash flood type of thing. And we used to, when I was a kid, we had this flood control basin near our house over in the San Fernando Valley that was like the Sepulveda flood control basin. And that thing would be like, you know, the LA River is like a tiny little creek over there in West Virginia or here in Oregon or something, a tiny little creek. And then it would turn into like the Colorado River when it would rain, because it was, you know, lined with cement and stuff. But no, that's not the norm over here. I mean, we have like, you know, to have a heavy rain event like that, like, I mean, I'm talking like maybe 2 inches fell in like 20 minutes. That was seriously, that's what's starting to happen around the world, too. I hear they had that happen in Argentina and China, and it's just these supercells come out and you know, it's just...
I saw a photograph of one, a supercell that barreled across. I saw it via... Buddy Beth on my Facebook page. I saw a photograph of a supercell that barreled across Oklahoma yesterday, and it was just, well, for somebody like me who lives around mountains, just being able to see that far is mind-boggling. I mean, you could see the whole damned weather system.
Yeah, yeah. Oh yeah. I remember I went to Europe in 2000, and when we were coming back, we had a stopover in Detroit, I think, or Chicago or something like that. But then we were coming across the Midwest, and there were just all of these supercells. I got some pictures of it. It was awesome because you could just see them as far as you could see, because the things, you know, were up like 40,000 feet, and you can just see these supercells all over the place. It was wild. But we don't get that. We get some thunderstorms up in the Cascade Mountains, which is like the mountains to the east of Portland.
It's right.
About, you know, an hour drive from here. But it, generally speaking...
Yeah, up into America's other temperate rainforest.
Right, right. It's mostly clear-cut out here, though, now.
Yeah.
I mean, that's say it's...
Jesus, that's sad.
Yeah, the old, there's very little old growth left in Oregon, and there hasn't been for a long, long time. It's been years. My sister used to have a farm out on the Coast Range in the 70s, you know, and that was my farm experience. We actually lived out there in a barn over a summer and built an A-frame house out there and had a beautiful time. But going back up there now is just really sad, because it's just the place is just raped out. And, you know, you can drive on the highways. It's kind of like a movie set, you know, right? Like 100 feet in from the sides of the highways, the trees are just clear cut.
Oh, yeah, that's always the way they operate until they feel comfortable enough, to just come right out in the open. It used to be that it was really kind of hard to see mountaintop removal around here until they decided, you know, screw it. You know, they're never going to be able to touch us. We're going to do whatever the hell we please. And then that's when they started coming right out to the road where you could see them. And then they started coming right up on top of people's homes.
Yeah, yeah. Well, with, at least with trees, I mean, with mountaintops, you can't replant, but at least with trees, you can. I remember a couple of years ago, it's been more than that, it's been about, 8 or 9 years ago, driving up to Mount St. Helens, and, you know, the volcano. And there's a lot of, you know, stuff that they planted in the 90s and stuff that they logged it out. And, it, you know, when you fly over it, in a plane, it's there's tons of clear cut out there, but at least they can replant trees. So,
yeah.
But they replant them with these crappy, you know, super Doug firs that aren't anywhere near the solid, heavy wood that originally came out of that area. It was like, there's a place over here in town that's like a junkyard for houses. It's called the Rebuilder Center. And I'll go over there sometimes to get wood if I need a 2x4 or something. But you get one of these old 2x4s out of a 1920s or 1910 house or something. And the thing weighs like, you know, 40 pounds or something. It's really substantial. Try to hammer a nail through it. And I mean, it's hard work.
Oh, the same thing happens with old barns around here, because I don't know how much you know about it, but one of the awful things that happened to the forests, and many awful things happened to the forests east of the Mississippi, but one of the things was the chestnut blight. And it wiped out every American chestnut just about this side of the Mississippi River, and none of them can grow to maturity anymore. But to this day, people who, woodworkers, craftsmen, whatever, will pay top dollar for old, they call it wormy chestnut.
Yeah.
Out of barns and old frames of old houses, and they'll pay more for the internal wood than the house itself is worth, or the barn itself is worth, and you can ruin nails in that stuff.
Yeah.
And God help you trying to saw it.
Yeah, yeah. Barn wood is expensive out here too, because old barns, like this one that I was telling you I had lived in. I was 15, so it was in 1975. This barn was falling down, and it finally ended up like lasting about another 2 or 3 years before it just collapsed. But I remember my sister, we had completed the house, and she was living out on the property with her husband at the time, and they had people that just came to them, and back in those days, and were saying, hey, can we buy the wood from you off this, you know, this just massive pile of old wood. And she made a lot of money off the wood, just, you know, selling that old barn wood.
Yeah, it kind of blows my mind. If I go out the road from where we live just a little ways, my great-grandfather's barn is still standing.
Oh, awesome. That's so awesome. So you're in a rural setting out there then?
Oh, very much so, yeah.
How far are you from, like, the nearest town then?
It's a 40-mile drive to Beckley. The county seat, Fayetteville, is 15 minutes away.
Dang. Yeah, so you're really...
6 miles from the grocery store.
Oh, my goodness.
Nearest convenience store is 2 miles, but, yeah, it's a pretty rural setting.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's really awesome. I, you know...
Well, it was until they blew it up.
Yeah.
I was telling Ferg, my son, a little bit about... I was actually using an analogy about how people will tolerate things for various reasons. And I was telling him, this house used to have the best water of anywhere in the community, because my grandmother, when she built the place, had, you know, usually a well driller will drill to the deal is he drills to the first vein of water.
Right.
And then anything beyond that, you pay by the foot.
Okay.
And the first vein of water was practically almost, well, this house practically sits on a spring.
Oh, nice.
Our basement is always wet, but it's skanky water, too.
Yeah, yeah.
It's red and stinky, and that's what everybody else around here had. But my grandmother had a bit of a perfectionist streak, and she drilled on down to 72 feet. Which was a fortune back in the day. But the water that came up out of there, Dave, I guess, you know, well, when I was a little kid and we would come up here to visit, the first thing I wanted to do as a little boy, I would run through all the way through the house back to the well. It was a well, not a well pump. It was a well,
right.
And it had one of those columnar capture devices.
Uh-huh.
And I would run back all the way back here to pull up a bucket of water because that water was somewhere near freezing.
Oh, really?
And it was the most crystal clear, pure, delicious, you know, 5 million year old water you ever tasted. And I would just delight in it and just drank from the bucket out of an aluminum ladle and just reveled in it. And then about the mid-80s, the coal companies came, and they strip mined on out the road from where we live.
Uh-huh.
And from that day forward, our well water had this sleazy, slimy sediment of truly slimy red goo in it that stank of death.
That's nasty. That's so nasty. I know it's, you know, I'll tell you, that farm that my sister had, she had, there was a spring, like a spring-fed creek that ran through her property. She was in this little canyon called Shot Pouch Canyon. She was like about 3 miles up this road, and then it was about 35 miles to Corvallis or Paloma, the smaller towns over there in north central Oregon. But this creek came right off of Mary's Peak, which is the biggest mountain around there. I think it's about 4,000 feet. Just a big glorified hill, actually. But the water coming off of there was just this, it was like snow melt. It was the freshest water that you could, it was the same thing, you know, there's like crayfish and trout in the stream, and it was, oh, it was idyllic. It was the most awesome. I really appreciate that as, you know, as a life experience and being able to have lived that at least.
Oh, there's nothing like it. When I was in college, I would come here and I would cart. I would come down here with empty jugs and fill up jug after jug of water and take it back to Morgantown with me, because we used to have a running joke that Morgantown, West Virginia, was the only place in the world you could get a glass of water very dry, because it was so loaded with calcium salts and all the crap that they had to put, because the Monongahela River is not particularly clean.
Yeah.
I was well in touch with that. I mean, my my other great grandfather's farm out the road, he had a, you know, what farmers had back in the 19th century. He had a spring house, and he had a little gathering area with an inlet and an outlet where the water was constantly circulating and it never rose up. And that's where he kept stored all of his perishables, his milk and his butter and his buttermilk, and magnificent.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, we got to do something about it. You really got to come up with some technology to purify all this water we've been.
Well, I don't know what can be done about the water that's already ruined, Dave. But it seems very clear to me that we have to stop ruining what remains.
Yeah, no doubt about it. It's just, I don't know. I don't know what.
Well, look, I mean, and you kind of opened a door for me into something that I'd hoped to get to this evening anyway, and that is this. Something really ugly happened in Illinois last night.
What's that?
The Illinois legislature passed, if I understand correctly, they passed the fracking bill.
For Chicago or the Chicago area? Or
no, for the state of Illinois.
The whole state. Uh-huh.
And they did so over the outcry of people who said, "We don't want we don't want a regulated fracking industry in Illinois. We want a moratorium on fracking."
Right.
And that wasn't just two or three people. There were a lot of people who wanted that moratorium. But the Sierra Club and the National Natural Resources Defense Council got together with the industry and put together this bill and got it through the Illinois legislature.
Well, this is the thing I'm wondering. What in the hell do they think is going to be the result of all of this? when the gas runs out. And I hear that that's a big scam anyway. They don't even get that much gas out of it. I was reading that the power plants in Texas now, they're starting to go back to coal because they ran out of natural gas out there from the fracking wells. What the hell are they? I can't understand what they think is going to happen.
Well, it's all the immediacy of instant gratification that runs all the way from, you know, from Veruca Salt's "I want it, Daddy, I want it now," to
right.
which winds up being the same philosophy of any given hydrocarbon CEO.
But it's like, so
get it now before they catch on to what we're doing to them.
But people have caught on, and they're still just powering it through. It seems like they're still just struggling.
Well, and what made the Illinois story worse, if I understand it correctly, Dave, is that it was done with the connivance of the Sierra Club and the Natural Resources Defense Council.
Well, I guess everybody's a prostitute these days. I can't understand what's going on. It's like.
But the problem is the grassroots were there saying, no, we're the ones who live here.
Right.
We don't want this. We want a moratorium. We want to draw a line in the sand, and we'll do the fighting. We're not afraid of these bastards. And the big greens said, well, now, wait a minute. We're much smarter than you pros are.
Right. Sure. Well, I don't know. I guess the outrage has to get enough, or everybody's just going to die of poisoned water. I mean, you got to have water. Water is so basic to survival. I don't understand it. It's homicidal. It's suicidal. It's insane. I mean, even rich people have to drink water. And when you ruin it all, I mean, you ruin it all. I just don't understand.
No, look, we've joked about it in the past, but they're bubble people. And they don't have to drink the same water we do. You know, the guy who runs the NRDC and the guy who runs the Sierra Club, they don't have to drink poisoned water in Pennsylvania. They don't have to drink poisoned water in West Virginia. They don't have to drink poisoned water in Illinois.
Well, they're doing it in California now, too, I hear.
Right, but they're not going to drink it because the people who get poisoned are the people who live near it and with it. And so they feel, you know, they feel insulated from that kind of thing.
Well, they're insane. They're out of their minds.
I tend to concur. Well, Dave, I tell you, it is really good to talk to you, but we've got the Friday on the Front Porch lineup started, and I appreciate you getting it all going for us. Have yourself a good weekend. I'll be in D.C. next week, but I hope to be running regular shows, if not normal ones. I don't think we've ever had a normal show in the history of this program, but and there I go saying show again.
All righty.
But I always enjoy our conversations.
Yes, I will talk to you soon.
All right.
Have a good trip in D.C. and everything.
Thanks, and I hope your Oregon weekend is as beautiful for the rest of it as it has been today.
All right, man. All right. See you later.
Bye now. And that's our buddy Dave calling from Portland. Onward we go. Hey, welcome to the program.
Yeah, yes, John.
Hey, John, what's up?
I haven't called in a while. I think that it's amazing that, first of all, like what does this guy think is going to happen? Does he think the intel agencies in the United States have never thought of a bunch of inbred hillbilly dumbasses, pardon my French, marching up there with a bunch of guns? What do you think, it's never occurred to the NSA that could happen? I mean, it's the most ridiculous. It's almost like they want people to think they're dumb.
Well, let's be careful about how we throw around inbred hillbilly dumbasses, okay?
Okay.
Being as how I am a hillbilly.
Well, you're awesome. I mean, there's no comparison to be made between you and them. I mean, these guys, first of all, they don't have a brain cell to work with.
No. I mean, you can. I suspect you could put a candle on one side of Adam Koresh's head and blow through his ear and blow it out on the other side. Not that I don't find that a little too intimate, but, you know.
Exactly. And it's like, what do they think? Do they think that after Koresh and McVeigh, that the NSA, the CIA, and all these other intel agencies didn't get together at some point and think, listen, we got to find some way to undermine this?
No, these dumb bastards are spoiling for a fight, okay, John? I mean, they just are.
But it's not going to be a fight. It's going to be... there's not going to be a fight. It's just going to be them getting obliterated, and whatever security services happen to be there at the time, you know, thinking, all right, well, that worked. We don't need plan B, C, D, or E. You know, it's not going to be a fight.
I hate to laugh, because what will follow on the heels of that is a bigger government crackdown. And I'm the last guy in the world to tune into for defense of the national security state.
Right.
But you see, these people really do want to see and I've been talking about this for years. These people really do want to see the end of the United States. And the thing is, the Republican Party is doing the best that it damn well can. They've just about ground the government to an absolute non-responsive halt, but it's not fast enough for the rest of these freaks. And, you know, they want to shoot at somebody. You got to lead them a little bit, don't you know?
Yeah, but, I mean, I said this before. Like, the Republicans are basically, like, they had their heyday pre-1960s. When the 60s arrived... Basically, everyone who's in the Republican Party with anyone any influence right now, they were just like, oh, look, you know, we're not privileged. We don't really matter that much anymore. And now we're going to have to live out the next 30 or 40 years wondering what happened to Jim Crow. I mean, that's all they had. And when it was taken, you know, they have nothing. They can put all the black candidates they want up there. It still doesn't mean that they're pro integration. They can put all the female candidates up there. It doesn't mean they're pro feminist. I mean, it's all they had was pre-60s, and that's it. So now all you've got is a bunch of people whose idea of America was, you know, Jim Crow pre-feminist. And that's it. So they don't have anything now.
Except the power to control the House of Representatives and the minority control of the Senate and the ability to grind government to a halt.
I mean, it's so ridiculous, though, because it's almost as simple as an Aesop's fable. And yet somehow it still exists. It's like we got this complex machinery of government, but you need something as simplistic as, you know, John Boehner to stop everything.
Well, consider the etymology of the word sabotage. You know, a sabot was a wooden shoe, and disgruntled workers would throw their shoe into the machinery of the Industrial Revolution and grind the damn thing to a halt. So right. To throw one's wooden shoe into a machine became sabotage, which became a euphemism for undermining an effort.
Well, what do you think? I mean, okay, I listen to people who call your show. A lot of them are extremely smart. What's her name? Sandra. She's like, she's also up to your level. But. What do you think, like, because I think that the premise that's kind of presented is wrong, in that a lot of people just assume that, you know, we've got so many, I'm intelligent, you're intelligent, a lot of people must be intelligent, you know, and they present their argument based on that premise, when the premise isn't even correct to begin with.
Well, but John, let me correct the record just in one regard. If I ever come across or open this microphone as Bob Kincaid's smart guy, that is not my intention, because there's an entire history of talk radio out there of smart people telling other people what to do. I mean, that godforsaken gas $50 million a year gas bag with the street drug habit,
right.
The oxymoron,
yeah.
Flush Flimball.
Yeah, but
that guy gets behind the microphone and says he's broadcasting with half his brain tied behind his back, or with talent on loan from God, which always made me and a buddy of mine holler, "Margin call!" Right? But
I mean, you can't confuse smart and authoritarian. I mean, you're smart, you're just not authoritarian about it. I mean, he's not even smart, he's just an authoritarian. That's all he's got. You know, that's all they do is like, oh, well, you know, if the argument's not correct, just yell louder.
True.
So it's like, I mean,
I think your fundamental inquiry, John, is going back to the notion, something that I've expressed on a number of occasions, that for the most part, people won't get off of their out of their seat and into the street,
right,
unless the issue is immediately, and I mean on top of them, touching them. And to that end, you know, I've heard, for instance, Malloy talk about the need to have a million people in Washington, D.C. who go there and don't go away. Because the idea of protest in Washington, D.C. is just part of the overall culture. It's like the cherry blossoms in the spring. And people show up in whatever number they show up in, and somebody counts them and hands the numbers off to the for-profit media. And if they mention it all, that's all they mention. Not necessarily right. The issue, but how many people showed up. Think about the bonus army that Douglas MacArthur attacked. Veterans come back from war simply wanting what was due to them, and they were treated like animals. There's a history of dissent in Washington, D.C., but the government wised up pretty quickly so that by 1963, you didn't have wholesale beatings when Dr. King led the rally in August, okay? And so what happens is you get all your permits and you say, okay, we're going to be there on July the 1st, and, you know, we'll be gone on July the 2nd, okay?
Right.
And so, I mean, it's almost impossible to get the local media in Washington, D.C., let alone the for-profit national media, to even show up to any of this stuff. And then if they do show up, they'll show a crowd shot, and then they'll show a shot of some, weirdos from the other side on the corner, you know, 15 of them standing there picking their teeth with their toenail clippings and their Gadsden flags, and they'll say, and the other side was represented too. So, you know, my ultimate thesis is that America will get off of its ass, get out into the street, and start making noise when the cable goes down.
Yeah, basically when they can't watch MTV or whatever the hell they're watching. I mean, it's just, but the thing too is that, like, we say, okay, we got a democracy, we got representative government, but the only representation we have, you know, I mean, it's probably like our local governments, because it's like when you get to that level, when you get to like the national level, these people are all bought out by whatever companies happen to be funding their campaign.
Well, there's that, and there's the gerrymandering too, and there's I forget how many hundreds of thousands of people each member of the House represents, generally speaking. I mean, for instance, I think there's like 1.8 million people in West Virginia. We've got three members of the House. Do the math. You know, that's a half a million. That's a half a million people per House member. Well, how can Madison was asking questions like this during the formative period of the Constitution. How do you make it so that you really are representing the people that you're representing and not not faction, as he called it. And I don't know that he came to a satisfactory answer, and I don't know that we ever have. But now that we've gone into this brave new world of wild-ass gerrymandered redistricting, all bets are off. I mean, see, that's one of those more grim moments that I touch upon from time to time. I get these pitches for fundraising from the Democratic Party. I just got one a few minutes ago from Nancy Pelosi. Oh, please. Yeah, me and Nancy, we're buds. About how, you know, we have a chance to break the May fundraising record. Well, let me call the Guinness boys. But what it boils down to is, And she's talking about, you know, getting a Democratic majority in the House in 2014, which, in the sort of relativistic comparison of Washington politics, would be a wonderful thing, a democratically controlled right. House. Something might they get passed once in a while. But the reality...
Right. I mean, it's like you can have the greatest government you want. You can have the greatest democracy you want. You can have the most impressive system of national politics that anyone has. But, you know, if your citizens are starving and they can't get medical attention and they can't do anything with their lives, then what good is it?
Right.
So, I mean, it's amazing that I do believe, as naive as this may sound, that we definitely have an amazing system of government. the problem, as you so, you know, you just put, is that problem you just stated is exactly the problem. It's like, okay, but they don't do anything. You know,
well, and, beyond that, John, let me get to my grim conclusion. Generally speaking, redistricting is accomplished in as a result of censuses. And we get those every 10 years, you know, sort of like locusts. But every 10, you know, so the next census is 2020. That's 1.5 presidential administrations away. So the census will take place in 2020. The redistricting will take place in 2021. And the first real redistricting opportunity in which the Democrats have a fighting chance is November of 2022, with a Congress, the 117th, that will be seated in January 2023.
Yeah, well, I guess.
That's like throwing cold water on me.
Oh yeah, well, come on. I mean, seriously, they're gonna get in there like they do every time, and capitulate and just ask if they can do anything more for the Republicans. Because that's what they do every time. I mean, and then, of course, they say they'll send you a little, you know, they'll send you a little little questionnaire. Hey, don't you like, you know, what the Democrats are doing? Don't you want us to do more? And then you say yes. And then they say, okay, well, let us bend our knees a little bit more to the Republicans, and then we might get to your questions, too. I mean, it's like great. So they might get in there in 2020-something. That means nothing will actually get done till 2030. You know, there are obviously great congressmen, you know, great representatives. You know, Bernie Sanders, I actually thought Olympia Snowe had some good aspects. But, I mean, for the most part, it's like they spend their days, they've even said this, they spend more time raising money.
Than they do.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, what? Why are they there? Why are they getting paid?
When you talk about campaign finance reform, which multimillionaire in either of those two august bodies is going to be the first one to lay his hands around the neck of the goose that lays the golden egg and start ringing?
Yeah. Unlikely.
Sadly, yes.
Boxes in the hen house.
I mean, and that's, you know, that I'm an, you know, you scratch a cynic and you find a disappointed idealist. I want things to be better. I badly do, John. But, you know, damn. Things like from time to time I'll hear from progressive circles even I'll hear we need a new constitutional convention, and at that point I start tearing at my clothing, ripping at my hair, howling like a beast of the field, and running around naked in the yard, because I just have this vision of a constitutional convention that's funded by the Koch brothers and Sheldon Adelman and you know, Richard Mellon Scaife, and we got poor little lonely George Soros over here trying to carry the weight by himself. You know, can you just imagine the Constitution that would come out of that?
Oh yeah, but the Koch brothers, they're smart enough to know that they want to hire, like, you know, Sonny Bono, or excuse me, Bono from Ireland. You know, hire some like progressive icon to do their bidding. Yeah, they're not going to hire, you know, Scott Walker. I mean, that's the joke of it, too, is that, you know, there's so many layers of bureaucracy and BS in all this that when you finally get to the actual talking about the meaning of it, you've exhausted every other, you know, form of will. I mean, it's ridiculous. It's like there could be a constitutional convention, but first you have to teach people what the Constitution means.
And of course, you just opened the door to... for me to say, which is precisely what Dr. Bill O'Brien is trying to do from 4 p.m. to 6 p.m. Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday of every week right here on this
and
little old network.
It's more impressive. He is extremely impressive. That's an understatement. But at the same time, how many people do you think, if given the choice, are going to pick between Dr. Bill O'Brien and, I don't know, dancing with whatever, just name someone.
Dancing with has-beens?
Exactly. Dancing with someone who no one's going to care about in 10 years. I mean, it's like they're going to pick
there's a lot of people who will pick Dancing with Has-Beens. There's a lot of people who will go over to the Outdoor Channel and watch an hour of Let's Shoot an Innocent Animal. There's you know, there's a significant other percentage of people who will go to the History Channel and watch a program about some guy who looks for old bed springs because there's a market for old bed springs now.
But
that's okay. You've got to have, John, you've got to have that core group of people who do think about this stuff, who do care about this stuff, who do swap ideas about this stuff. Because if you look to the history of just about any polity in human memory, you'll find that the way that they develop is that a very small number of people are the people who advance the cause. There weren't even 33% of the colonial Americans who were in favor of independence from Great Britain. Not even a third.
Oh, really?
Probably not even a fourth.
Wow, I didn't know.
Because their world wasn't touched by most of this stuff because a lot of them were subsistence farmers.
Right.
They had much greater concerns. They were concerned with whether the deer were going to eat their corn crop. They were concerned with whether or not it was going to rain. They were concerned with whether in the middle of winter they were going to starve to damn death.
Right.
And whether they starve to death with a king or some sort of representative government had very little to do with them.
Yeah.
But as the thing began to gain momentum, people choose sides in fights. I don't like the word. People choose sides in struggles when they become interested enough to care which side of the struggle wins. I mean, you can apply this even to media. There was that vast wasteland of time in terms of radio, for instance, when just about the only progressive liberal voice out there was Mike Malloy, laboring on day after day, night after night, and kicking ass in the ratings, no less.
Okay.
But just about the only one out there. And people flocked to so-called conservative talk radio because there was nowhere else to flock to. Because everybody wants to be a winner, right? You want to be on the side that's right. You want to be on the side that's got the answers. And if one side's out there unable to even provide any answers, with very few, you know, very limited exceptions, despite how good someone is at it, well, what's the outcome going to be?
Yeah, no, I see your point. It seems like the struggle is so incremental that people who might be more interested if it was a little bit more pronounced don't even get into it because they're like, okay, well, maybe in 2 weeks they might decide what question they'd like to ask if they ever get the chance.
Right.
You know, so it's like, I take your point that it's like, yeah, you at a certain point, everyone's like, whoa, this is getting big. We got to pick a side here. But the thing is that the machinery is so, it's almost like watching a machine that and you know the machine is programmed to do exactly what it's supposed to be doing, but as you're watching it, you realize that it's literally purposely confusing you. You know, it's programmed precisely to make you think, what the heck is going on here?
And perhaps to get you so frustrated that you walk away.
Right, exactly. And that's the thing too, is that your point is correct that eventually people will choose a side. But in the process of trying to contemplate what the actual issue is, how many people are gonna take that time? I mean, that's the thing. It's like, you know, you're right. You know, of course I say this. This is, you know, repetitious. You're definitely right. I very few times when I think you're wrong. But at the same time, it's like, what does that do for people who are barely even interested to begin with? I'm not.
Well, I mean, I think the answer is, to the extent that I'm in the answer business, the answer is the people who are interested, the people who have to care, who do care, have to. I mean, we can't, you can't walk away. I can't walk away because I'm going to come back because we've got some vested interest in this struggle, and we have to keep on doing what we're doing against the day when people do become engaged. And we have to have structures in place so that people can advance themselves once they realize that, whether they realized it before or not, they've got a dog in the hunt, and the hunt is on.
I mean, do you think that because, I mean, you must know that the Citizens United decision basically, like, toppled things massively, massively towards the other side. You know, so it's like, do you think that at a certain point, you know, people are going to be like, you know, why worry about my campaign financing when I can actually try to turn this around? Because right now, basically, you got the people who are in charge of making the laws being funded by the same people who they're supposed to regulate. So it's almost like continuously redundant or continuously hypocritical. Like what's you know that.
Well, and see that's how David Adam Koresh, that's how he gets to that nihilistic place where he is, where he wants to go and start shooting things.
Yeah, but don't even get me started on his little speech, because if you actually read that and then watch the movie V for Vendetta, it's almost word for word. It's almost like he just read the script and took it out of the script. I mean, the guy needs to get away from the television screen and actually do some reading. I mean, there's no comparison to be made between wondering why the machinery is so slow and whatever the hell he was doing. I don't know what he was doing, but it certainly wasn't an intellectual dialogue of any sort. I mean,
he's a phony intellectual.
He's not. Yeah, I mean, he's like a Rush Limbaugh or a what's that other guy's name? Sean Hannity.
Sure.
I mean, it's like they get up there and they're like, oh, you know, let me say a few 4-syllable words in a row and hope that you don't actually look into any of it, and that passes for intellect. It's like what WTF.
And you know there's another thing, and quite frequently a person like this goes under the heading of demagogue, but you've got to have somebody at the front of the parade who is charismatic enough to make people care, to make people think that the leader's struggle is their struggle.
Right.
And frankly,
right. Too often personality gets confused with intelligence when the two don't coincide at all. When what you're talking about is someone who has both.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, look at FDR. Or look at the way that Kennedy motivated a young generation to aim for the stars.
Yeah, dude, that's bizarre, man. I've met people who were, you know, in their heyday back then who still think of that, and they get all, like, misty-eyed, and I'm like, dude, that was, like, 40 years ago. Like, what's... And they're like, no, but it was amazing. And I'm like, okay. So he must have done something pretty amazing, because it's like people who... You know, I've met people who, you know, they're regularly serious, you know, sober types of people, and they'll start talking about that and get all, like... reminiscent, you know what I mean? It's like, whoa, like, what happened?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, you think that in this, here's the thing, that's the thing too, is that in this day and age of information and mass media, there's so many people who are all like, look at me, you know, that's just one more sort of like added thing. And I'm not saying, by all means, I'm not saying it's not possible. Of course it's possible. I mean, that's actually part of the beauty of our system, is that the possibility exists. But the fact that there's so many different, like, oh, look at me, to sort of confuse and distract, it's like, oh, you know.
Right.
You basically got Occam's Razor and MTV kind of working together. I mean... You know, not literally, of course, but you understand what I'm saying.
No, it operates sympathetically.
Right, and not even intentionally. That's like the worst part. It's like it's not even designed to do that. It just does it.
And well, I don't know. There's a nexus here when we start talking about entertainment and amusing ourselves to death and bread and circuses, where you wonder how much of it was accidental. and how much of it was deliberate. And, you know, this is not the part where we wrap our heads in aluminum foil or anything like that.
Right. No, but I mean, if you look at
we have created a distracted populace that has little or no interest in participating in a government which, and this part is deliberate, and I've tried to talk about it from time to time, John, but look how prevalent it is, how pervasive it is for even progressives to say, you know, they're all corrupt in talking about government, or yeah, he's the one who got caught, but they all do it. The Republican part.
Progressives say that?
Sure, I've heard progressives say that. I've heard the well-intentioned people who have wandered off into the weeds of the Green Party say that.
Right.
You know, Ralph Nader said in 2000 that there wasn't a dime's worth of difference between the Democrats and the Republicans. Well, how did that election turn out? And I have respect for Ralph, okay? But I also know that was a meme that was invented in the Deep South in the 1960s and was trumpeted by George Wallace, who in his independent run in 1968 said there's not a dime's worth of difference between a Republican and a Democrat.
Yeah, but that's something Republicans always say to kind of confuse the issue, you know.
Well, they don't. No. They're not saying it to confuse anything, John. They're saying it to drive people out of the process. It is another kind of voter suppression.
Yeah.
What's the point in going to the polls if they're all the same?
Right. Well, that's what I mean. It's like they're basically trying to kind of distract from actually focusing on the issues and say, you know, why care about the issues when everyone's the same? I mean, it's. I don't care what Ralph Nader said. I mean, that's a silly... I mean, at the very least, it's a silly comment. I could use some stronger words, but I won't. I mean, it's like there's a...
But it was said. I mean...
Right.
Take anybody out there with a progressive... You know, with two molecules of progressive in them and ask them, did you ever think you would see the day when Ralph Nader was quoting George Wallace?
No.
Because that's true.
Yeah, but does he even know he's doing that? I mean, I understand your point. It doesn't matter. It's the inherent.
No, it's just been translated generationally through the culture.
Right.
I mean, how many phrases does any given user of English speak on any given day that makes its first origin in the folios of Shakespeare? I mean, there are people out here who don't have a ninth grade education, probably within 2-3 miles of me, who will talk about a neighbor and say he's a piece of work. Okay, well, that shows up in Shakespeare. What a piece of work man is. I think it's in the Tempest. I think Miranda says it.
I guess I'm thinking more metaphorically than literally, but I understand your point. It's like people basically. It's like the whole
ideas embed themselves in the zeitgeist.
Right, history repeated. It's like they repeat something without even realizing it because they never took the time to learn it. I mean, I don't know. That's you know, there's so many different tangents that you could take here. It's just there's so many different obvious points of like what's going on. It's like why, first of all, there's so many historical, you know, points of reference that people could pay attention to in all this that they just don't. You know, and I'm not getting on all the whole, like, oh, they're bad people. They're not bad people. They're just busy people. You know, they have lives to live. They have stuff to do. I get that. But at the same time, it's like, it's obvious, you know, it's like that, you kind of reminded me of this. It's like that Shakespeare thing, cry havoc and let slip the dogs of war.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like that, how many times does that happen? Not even on a military level, but just on a policy or media level. And how many times do you see some idiot on TV talking about how this is so horrible, and then you look at it and you're like, yeah, that's not really horrible. You're just crying havoc so you can release the dogs of war.
Wait, cry havoc. That was Shakespeare? I thought that was Klingon. Never mind, sorry, I'm being smart aleck. But no, I understand exactly what you're saying.
Yeah, it's like, I mean, it's like what, you, just that point of reference alone, you know, it's like it's so metaphorically translated every single day, and yet people are just like, yeah, whatever, you know, who cares? He just said it. Who cares? But at the same time, then you got like 30 other people grabbing onto it. Oh, yeah, let's repeat this. And then you got people who won't take the time to read a newspaper or look at a magazine, watching the TV. Oh, my gosh, look at this. It's a big issue. No, it's not a big issue. You're just not taking the time to look farther enough into it. So.
Yeah, and when when there's a reason for people to be engaged, they will engage. And you know, we one other caveat that attaches to all this, John, is that we need to be careful about the assumptions we make about who is engaged, because even though Bildo O'Reilly will occasionally talk about the hundreds of thousands of people who watch him, or you know how high his numbers are up above whoever his competition is at MSNBC.
Mm-hmm.
There's one little truth that never gets mentioned, and you know what that is?
What's that?
They're both getting their asses whipped by SpongeBob.
Yeah, no, and you know, I just thought of something because you said that. It's, have you ever noticed? And I'm not sure. You know, I have no kind of history in linguistics or anything like that, or communications history. You know, the development of it. But have you ever noticed that a lot of times when you see someone, I don't care where it is, basically like screaming at the top of their lungs about something, half the time they're doing it, it's not even true. And it basically, I don't remember when I noticed this, but it's almost like, it's kind of like that saying, if it looks like an advertisement, it probably is. You know, it's like these people, they say, oh, look, this is so horrible, this is so, or whatever, and then you look at it and you think, okay, that was definitely an advertisement because there's nothing there. And that applies to so many things that I can't even, you know, I can't even mention. Not because I can't, just because there's not enough time.
Right, I get it.
I mean, it's just what, you know, it's like, that's a very simple sort of barometer or measurement to kind of look at, you know, modern events by. In other words, like, how loud are they screaming and where's the actual truth?
Precisely.
Yeah.
Well, I tell you what, John. This has been a lovely conversation, and it has been a while, but it's always quality when we get into this.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you're definitely awesome. So I just, you know, keep being amazing and awesome, and you know, don't let the Republicans stupid get too loud.
It can get pretty deafening. What's really frustrating is when our side starts doing it. I've actually got an example of that if I can get to it tonight.
Awesome.
But barring that, we'll talk about it maybe on Monday. All right, John, thank you very much. It's awful good to hear from you. You have a wonderful weekend.
Thank you. You too. Thank you.
Bye now. And we will keep it going. Larry's been very patient on the Skype line. Hey, Larry.
Hi, Bob. How are you? Can you hear me?
I hear you great. You got good audio.
Thank you very much. This is a very nice little thing that I have. I'm recuperating here, so I figured I'd call up. I haven't talked with you for a while. Those were a couple of really good calls you had. I really enjoyed the call with John and Mark. Was that the first person that you talked with?
No, that was Dave.
Dave. Okay, those were some really good calls. I don't think I can top those. But
you're no slouch yourself, so you know, don't sell yourself short.
I appreciate that. A couple of things. I called Jackie Spears' office, and I also called Kevin Mullen. Kevin Mullen is the state representative that used to work with Jackie Spiro back in the day, and about 20 years ago or so, and they never called me back. So I don't know whether or not Mr. Mullen got my call or got my message, and I don't know if my request got over to Jackie Spears. So I tried to get in touch with her about the AIC Act. So I'm hoping you'll be able to get over when you're over in Washington, D.C. and get to some of our California delegation and see if we can get more signers onto the AIC Act. It would be really good to do that. The other thing, there have been a number of programs on today and also a number of authors that are talking now finally about labor having to wake up and labor having to rank and file having to be motivated to get the union reps to start doing some more agitation on their behalf, as opposed to just sort of using electoral politics as a way of organizing. And Stanley Aronowitz was on with with Richard Wolff, Dr. Richard Wolff, who's an economist who teaches in New York. He's originally from University of Massachusetts. And I also noted a couple of interviews today. Both were on KPFA. One was on a KPFA local program here in Berkeley with Brian Edwards Tekert. And he was interviewing an author, and I can't remember that author's name. I'll have to get it from Brian if I ever call over there and have a chance to talk with him. But I do know that on Counterspin, which is, I think Counterspin is Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. They were doing an interview with Dr. Bob McChesney. And both of them, both of these authors were talking about the fact that the internet, when it was developed, the visionaries of computer communication were hoping that the internet would be used in a particular way to encourage people to engage and use critical thinking skills and do advocacy and also do research using libraries and you know, getting a flow of ideas as you would have in a university and so on and so forth. But the way in which the internet has developed is you've got a number of, you know, you've got these big monopolistic communications development groups, and also, you know, these the big internet providers. Comcast is mine. Unfortunately, I don't have any other option except for a very small one here. You've also got, you know, social networking. And the social networking people like Facebook and Twitter present themselves as a free option for people, and people think that they're getting this for free, but they're actually, every time that they go on to the Facebook is gathering information on their buying habits and gathering information on their lifestyle habits, and they're sharing these findings with the government. And a number of our people on the Horn Molloy chat, I'm not going to mention any names right now, are very afraid of the way in which the internet is being used and are very concerned about privacy. And that really wasn't the aim of the original, you know, the architects of the internet. And the internet was used originally, as you know, by the Department of Defense.
Absolutely.
They developed the network as a means to try to keep some lines of communication open if there ever was a nuclear attack. And then scientists used to use it to send research back and forth, and also to communicate with each other, send files back and forth. And now you see how the internet's being used. And we're just being deluged with all of this superficial stuff. And I don't know if I can add anything to the call that you had with John earlier, but what I can say is that it seems that in our society, and maybe in every society, every civilization known to man, that every time that there's some changes going on, the changes or the superficial changes that you see in a culture are surface changes. But the deep structure of the culture and the deep structure of the values never really change. So, you know, that's what I can add to the call that you had with John, and what you were saying about the fact that people will start, you know, rising up when they feel something, like when they lose their cable. And I have another example of that happening with people with disabilities. About 20 years ago, one of the directors of the Independent Living Center in Marin County was saying that, you know, the people with disabilities that call them are more concerned about their cable going down than they are about fighting for, you know, legitimate or fighting for greater inclusion in the larger society and an economic.
Well, and I think, Larry, that's exactly what I was referring to with John, that this is going to remain a complacent society as long as the cable's on.
Well,
I mean, as long as you can tune in, let's hunt a defenseless animal, or let's go buy a rusty bedstead.
Well, you know, I have so many channels.
Well, and I don't want to sound like an elitist, because, you know, I've got stuff. I've got a few things I tune into. I'll watch a basketball game. I'll watch a race.
Yes.
But that's because sometimes you have to run away from the information overload.
Yeah, and the information is not substantive enough to be able to engage the average person in a dialogue about the information so that they develop some critical skills at being able to really, you know, understand. And the critical thing about getting dialogue going isn't so much for me getting the information so I can shoot the other person down with a rhetorical argument that can, you know, knock them out. It's to try to understand the other person and to try to develop some, like I was talking about when I was interested in learning about Southern culture, you know, when I was on chat with you and some of the other people earlier, you know, I'd like to try to develop, you know, make some common cause with people, because people are the most important, you know, element in this. People create culture. Well, they don't create, you know, they're not, you know, but people create, you know, social culture and symbols and that sort of thing. And people can make things better. There's no such thing as perfection, as everybody knows, but it seems that, like John was saying, people, and like you were saying, people are so concerned, and Ray Taliaferro, to quote him, he says, people have to be concerned with putting food on the table and clothes on the back. And the struggle to do that keeps people from having the intellectual ability or curiosity to go further, to be able to reflect on what's going on so that they can actually do something. So, you know, I don't know what else to say, but that's what it seems to me. And I can tell you that Stanley Aronowitz and Garl Perowitz and Richard Wolff are all talking about developing some other structure so that workers can develop, like the Argentinian model. I think you may have seen the movie by Naomi Klein and her husband Avi. It was called The Take, about what happened in Argentina.
I'm familiar, yes.
Yeah, and, you know, and it's the same thing that has to happen. I know you were talking about fracking, you were talking about what happened in Illinois. I'm not there, I'm in California. There have been a number of protests and a number of actions done over the last couple of days to try to get Jerry Brown to change his mind about allowing fracking. Also,
well,
on democracy.
What in God's name is in his? Listen, this is a different Jerry Brown from the one that dated Linda Ronstadt. I think we all understand that now.
Yes.
But.
Well, yeah. Well, what you need to understand about Jerry Brown, and I don't know the man personally, but I do know people that have known him, and he's a politician, and he's very, very intelligent. And he had a show on KPFA back in the day called We the People. But as times moved on, he wanted to get back into power. And he, you know, he adapted himself to the political realities that are happening today. And that's what he's about, basically. He's about basically
Let me ask you this, though, Larry. Let's take a couple of premises. One being that, for instance, I think more than 50% of all dollars donated to environmental causes come from California, you know, mm-hmm. from one state.
Mm-hmm.
So that's obviously going to be a big force to be reckoned with for any politician inside that state. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So far, so good?
Yeah.
Well, what happens when the Sierra Club, which is headquartered where?
Sierra Club is headquartered in the Bay Area, I believe.
San Francisco, absolutely.
Yeah, that's right.
What happens when the Sierra Club goes out and advocates for fracking in a place like Illinois? Well, don't you know, if you're Jerry Brown, don't you know that the door must be pretty much open for you to give it the green light in California?
Yeah. But he's concerned about fitting into the mainstream now, and he perceives the mainstream.
But my point is that if you don't even have to worry about that pushback anymore, you've pretty much got your own. You've got your own thing.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like living in West Virginia and being supported by the NRA.
Well, I can't. I can't speak for Jerry Brown. And I don't know him that well, but as I said, I do know people that knew him. I knew a woman who's actually changed his diapers, who is no longer alive, because her mother was a bigwig in the Democratic Party, back in the 50s and 60s, and was involved with the California Democratic Council. And I can also tell you, and I want to let your listeners know, when I was involved with the Democratic Party on the state level, I would go to a number of these executive board meetings, and also a number of the conventions for a number of years. And what happens in conventions specifically is you have your caucus meetings. Your caucuses are basically advisory committees to advise the party on how to best bring more people with disabilities, in my case, or more, people from rural counties into the party. And we're supposed to be doing outreach to that constituency group. And then you've got all the various standing committees, and you can imagine what they are, rules and finance and legislation and platform and all those. And all those committees work together to nominate candidates and also to put together a platform, a winning platform that will get the most number of Democrats elected. And they don't want to go too far to the left because they don't want to do any kind of advocacy such as you or I might want to do with the AIC Act, because they don't want to be seen as trying to push or trying to force the various candidates to take any kind of really strong positions. And they don't want to alienate anybody because their big thing is getting Democrats elected. And if you're in a liberal district, such as I'm in Alameda County or in Marin County, they want to push the Democrat there. And if you're a Democrat in Fresno County, or in Bakersfield or something, they're going to push the Democrat who's running there, even though that Democrat might be really, really conservative. That's the function of the party. And the function of the party, in addition to that, is to try to get as much money as they possibly can. And the people that they go to get that money are normally the people that have identified themselves as volunteers on campaigns, people that volunteer on campaigns, people that are part of the party structure, and they continually go to that well. Like PBS goes to its members all the time, or Pacifica Radio goes to its members, or you might go to your listeners and ask for funds. But it's a fundraising. Everything is fundraising. Everything from, everything that they send out, everything that they do at conventions. And, normally at the conventions, what they do after they do the caucus meetings and the, basically standing committees, is the next day is the big media day, when all of the candidates and all of the, headlining politicians for that particular season will come and give speeches all day. And then the next day after that, that's when the party does its business. And they either will ratify a platform, 1 year, and then 2 years later, what they will do is they will look at various resolutions, and people normally submit maybe 50 to 100 to 150 resolutions, all on topics that they might want to see the party take up. And then the party sort of cobbles together resolutions that look similar, or they normally vet all 100 of those resolutions, and then they pick 10 of the big ticket resolutions that they think are going to be dealt with in the coming election, and then they take stands on those, or they'll take stands on propositions. And that's what the Democratic Party does. I don't know what the Republican Party does, but I imagine it's pretty much similar. Does that jive with your experience, Bob?
Largely, yes. I mean, yeah. I think that's the nature of the process, isn't it?
Yeah. So I just wanted to let the people that are listening know what actually goes on, And also, I can say that the Nation has an article that says that what we need, what radicals need, is a new American radicalism, which is exactly what Stanley Aronowitz was saying today on Richard Wolff's Economic Update. The whole structure of the society has to change, and has to reconfigure itself. And I don't think that can be done from me or any one particular person going there and saying we need a change. The people, like Saul Alinsky was saying, and he became more moderate as he got older. But what he was saying is, you don't go into an area and try to organize a particular community or try to organize a workplace thinking that you know what's best for the people in that workplace.
That's exactly where I was going, Larry.
Yeah.
And that is exactly what we have experienced so much of. You know, you have done tremendous labor in support of the ACAC. And the ACAC was born out of the determination of people who live with mountaintop removal to deal with mountaintop removal and end mountaintop removal.
Mm-hmm.
And we only did that after we listened to the alleged smart people who said they knew what was good for us stupid hillbillies, and we listened to them for a generation. And now that we have sort of left the neighborhood, suddenly they don't want to play anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a nasty little lesson in organizational politics.
Mm-hmm. Well, what Saul Alinsky said in his most recent book before he passed away, he said if people want to organize, first of all, they have to have egos and they have to believe in power. They can't go in there and not have an ego. It's that, you know, you have to have some kind of self to be able to do it. You have to be able to. But he also said that if you're going into an area that's a conservative area, and you realize that people are going to be off-put by your appearance. Like if I go somewhere and people are off-put by my appearance, I have to be able to present myself in a way and do impression management in such a way that I can appeal to the people that I'm trying to get to listen to me. And I cannot, and I have to try to present the case in a way that helps them to feel that they're the ones that are coming up with the idea. The idea didn't come from me. It came from them. It came organically from them. And then that's what happens a lot with the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. The Democratic Party will decide on a candidate, or the funders of the party will decide on a particular candidate. The candidate didn't necessarily organically come from the grassroots of that community. It came from various movers and shakers who were involved in the party. And like you said, there are always a few people who are going to be politically active, and the majority of people are going to be out there. And you said that very, very clearly when you were talking with John. But the thing is that this candidate has to come from the hood, so to speak. Otherwise, people won't believe in it. And that's why you have an African American community and a Latino community, so on and so forth. And people in other communities who feel so deadened or feel so alienated from the process of going to vote in the first place, because the candidate did not come from them. So that's the thing. And Ben Jealous was on Democracy Now! Today, and he was talking about the governor of Virginia. I can't remember his name, but apparently the governor of Virginia decided that people who are nonviolent felons, he was going to allow them to vote now.
Right.
I hope that that's progress. I don't know how much progress it is, but I hope that that's going to be progress.
I remain a cynic. I'm sorry, but where Republican politicians and ballot access are concerned, I'm a real tactile, I'll believe it when, you know, visual, I'll believe it when I see it kind of guy.
But if you're a grassroots Republican and your family's voted Republican for generations, and that's all you know, and basically you're a really good person who really believes in people around in your community and so on and so forth, but all you hear is Republicanism, and you're involved in a conservative church, then you're still, you know, you may be a good person, and maybe in a different cultural environment, you may tend toward being a Democrat, but I mean, you know where I'm going with this, but there have to be people like that out there. You know, there have to be good people who are basically, you know, basically would be a Democrat in any other cultural situation, but because they grew up and because their families have voted Republican for so many generations, they can't conceive of any other way of looking at the world. You know, I don't know, but maybe you can answer that.
Look, the only answer to that is that one hopes that at some point the idea of acting politically within the scope of one's enlightened self-interest will somehow begin to take the forefront. Larry, this has been a night of three wonderful conversations, and yours, you said you didn't know if you, you know, you did just fine, and I'm also glad you called. And by the way, that one magazine you were asking about is
Facing South, and the other one I can't recall the other
Oxford feature.
The Oxford American. Thank you very much. I think
they're a .org too, although it's more literary. It's kind of a literary magazine, but it's artistic kind of stuff.
Yeah, there's another book that was written. Who's the fellow that started it was Miles Horton, but it was an autobiography or a biography of the Highlander
school, Center. Yeah.
And that started the Highlander School.
And you know what? There's also a biography out there of Don West.
Yes.
And of course, Don West was a mentor of Jeff Biggers, who is a dear friend of this program.
Oh, cool.
Who was actively involved in the struggle in Illinois. And you might search for that as well.
Is that Haiti West's, Haiti West, 500 Miles, the song 500 Miles? I don't know if they were related.
Well,
maybe they
Don West and Miles Horton were colleagues for a time in the founding of the Highlander Center.
I see.
And then Don came on up to West Virginia and founded the Appalachian Folklife Center.
Cool. That's very, very, you know, that's very, very good information.
And of course, with your love for politics, I can never recommend highly enough. And I've been reading from it a couple of times, just because there's always something relevant in it. What I consider to be the single most brilliantly written work of fiction in American English history, and that's Robert Penn Warren's All the King's Men. And it doesn't get any more Southern than that.
Great. Well, that's very good information.
And it's deeply political.
Yes, I'm a little bit burned out of organized politics, kind of like I'm burned out of organized religion and organized everything else, because I think it has to come from within me. But the problem of it being personal is that I would like there's a kind of psychology out there that grew out of humanistic psychology called transpersonal psychology, and I kind of like to have my personal feeling, you know, my sense of being existentially, personally, being involved. I like to feel that kind of feeling universally with all the rest of the people. You know what I'm saying?
Yes, I do.
I feel isolated having my own
right.
Personal...
You say you're burned out on organized religion, organized politics, and organized everything. What you're burned out on is authority structure, Larry.
Yeah.
And I understand that deeply. You have a good weekend, and listen, great good thoughts on the healing and recovery of your leg.
Yeah, thank you very much. I'm recovering, and I should be up. I don't know. I'll definitely be up on June 10th. That's when I see the orthopedist. I'll talk to you soon.
All right.
And have a great weekend. If I don't talk with you later on, and I love everybody in the chat room, Bob. They're really great people.
Yes, they are. Yes,
right,
they are. Take care, Larry.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Bye now. That's Larry calling from the Bay Area. Wow. Just wow. This program is not about me. This program is about what y'all bring. Hey, welcome to the program.
Is it about me?
It's about you too, Richard.
Was that Stockton Larry?
No. That was a different Larry.
Oh, okay.
He pops in from time to time as me Gimp.
Okay, good, because I was a little confused because I thought Stockton Larry was in Vegas, and this fellow was really up on Bay Area politics. So where I am. Hey, I was. I'm sorry I missed you when you were out here. I would have come running over if I had known that you were.
I would love to, but the fact of the matter was, with the exception of a brief interlude to have one of those life transforming experiences of going sailing out on the bay. My dance card was pretty well pre-filled for me before I ever got on the plane.
Yeah, I understand. I understand. Was that so? Where did you sail out of?
I think more or less near Richmond.
Yeah, I would guess from Richmond itself.
Yeah, we crossed the Bay Bridge and wound along the. Other at the outside of the bay, and that was Tom who gave me that tremendous experience.
Oh, cool! Yeah, that's very nice to do. It's been it's been over 30 years since I've been out on the bay in a small boat. But yeah.
Well, Tom's got a beauty.
By the way, I had a job for a while. I was working in the San Francisco Ferry Building. And I took the ferry to work every day from Richmond. We actually had a ferry that started when the bridge collapsed, when that big piece of the Bay Bridge fell down.
Right.
Well, we had a ferry service, and boy, was that a nice way to go to work.
Oh, I'll bet it was.
It beat the hell out of bar. There was even a snack bar on the boat because it was a tourist boat. It was one of those Bay Cruise boats.
Yeah. At some point in my existence, I desperately hope to get back, and that's the kind of place you look at and you go, I'd like to live here for a couple of years.
Well, it does have its problems.
And I realized I got the rose-colored glasses tour too.
There's something about that, yeah. Because I felt that way when I first came here.
There's just this funky openness that is a far cry from the hills and hollers of West Virginia, Richard. And that's all there is to it.
And that's too bad, because I have to say that my interactions with people from your state, that people have been friendly, at least to me.
Oh, we are. But we're also insular and clannish. And that's clan with a C, not clan with a K.
Well, I mean, I remember, when I was a child, you couldn't get around in your, in your state. It's like there were no superhighways. There were places you could only get to by train.
Yeah. Yeah, oh, yeah.
People didn't...
No, it is a fairly... Listen, I mean, it's a fairly new concept. The New River Gorge Bridge, which is just a couple of miles from me, only opened in like 1976, which I mean, that's 37 years ago. But prior to that, it's a 15-minute drive for me to run over to Fayetteville, West Virginia, which is the county seat.
And that's in your county. That's not over on the other side.
Yeah, it is on the other side. The New River bisects my county.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And going via the four lane and the New River Gorge Bridge, it's 15 minutes. On the other hand, before that bridge opened, it was a 45-minute mountain ordeal.
Yeah. I don't think people realize what I perceive as the insularity of West Virginia in the past.
Oh, and see, you say in the past, but it's really not. I mean, for instance, my dear colleague Bo, with whom I work on the AIC Act so closely, he's probably 20 miles from me, tops, as the crow flies.
Yeah.
It's an hour's drive. and, you know, 40 miles of that is four lane, and then the rest of it is twisting two lane, you know, down into the heart of the mountaintop sacrifice zone.
Right, right. Well, you know, I have relatives in Charleston.
Right, yeah.
And I used to visit them every so often. To me, as a kid growing up in New York, it was like magic being in West Virginia.
Magic? Hell, it must have been like Mars.
Well, it sort of was.
Only with greenery. No, and that's so true, Richard, and sadly we're running out of time. But, you know, I'll just say this much. That trip over to my buddy Bo's. You go down there to where Bo lives and where so many of my other friends live, and on a cool spring evening with the sun having dipped below the mountains a couple of hours before, but light still in the sky, the light itself is magical. Things take on a golden glow, and it is beautiful and transcendent and, pick a magical adjective. And then...
Where is he?
In an area, it's called Naoma. It's back east, more or less, on Route 3 from Whitesville.
Okay, I don't know where that is.
But the thing is, if you look at it on Google Earth, what you'll see is that there's this massive, nasty mountaintop removal operations of thousands of acres now.
Oh, yeah.
And so on one of those golden evenings with the light still in the sky, you come back up a little ways and you turn around and look, and there's this persistent haze that overhangs the whole area of the Little Coal River.
Yeah.
And
boy,
it's poison. It's toxic.
Yes.
It is death hanging in the air.
Well, we're sort of out of time. You know, there was some political stuff.
Yeah, we are sick. No, I mean, like, I got to go now because it's like 59 minutes and 30 seconds. So
I got it.
We will get after it soon, I hope, Richard.
Okay, wrap it up. I'll talk to you later. Bye.
Later. Bye. Been kind of a West Coast night with the exception of John's call. Thanks to everybody. We are still $935 contributions away from our $350 goal. Hopefully that'll happen sometime before 3 a.m. Eastern or midnight Pacific. Thanks to everybody who makes all of this happen. Have a wonderful weekend. Rick Smith's on the way.